From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the queen of rockabilly, Wanda Jackson. When she toured with Elvis Presley in the mid-50s, he convinced her to try to cross over from country to rock and roll. She had a top 40 hit with a song he first recorded, Let's Have a Party. She also had country music hits like In the Middle of a Heartache and Right or Wrong. Now at the age of 65, she has a new CD that also features Elvis Costello and Dave Alvin. Also, actor Robert Forster. He starred in the 1969 film Medium Cool. His career was revived when Quentin Tarantino cast him as a bail bondsman in Jackie Brown. Forster is co-starring in the new ABC crime series Karen Sisko. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush signed the Partial Birth Abortion Act into law today, but within an hour, a federal judge in Nebraska issued a limited court order temporarily barring enforcement of the law. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Federal Judge Richard Kupf, a Reagan appointee, issued a temporary restraining order this afternoon. While Congress has found there are no instances in which a woman's health can be harmed by a ban on this procedure, said the judge, the Supreme Court has found otherwise. The judge was referring to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling 3 years ago invalidating a similar law because, among other things, it did not include a health exception. Judge Kupf's ruling applies to four doctors who brought the legal challenge and anyone they work with, supervise, teach, consult, or make referrals to. The four doctors operate in many states across the country. Similar legal challenges are pending in New York and San Francisco on behalf of more than half the abortion providers in the country. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A study of the August 14th blackout that struck large parts of the Midwest and East says the power failure spread because grid operators failed to warn utilities quickly enough. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more.
The Michigan Public Service Commission, which regulates electric utilities in that state, says its own power companies did what they were supposed to do last August when major power lines started going out. The commission's 2.5-month study of the blackout blames operators in central states and the East for failing to communicate when their part of the power grid started to fail. Grid operators keep track of voltage levels and the flow of electric current through the system of transmission lines that crisscrosses the country. The Michigan study is the first to come out since the blackout, which affected millions of Americans for days. The report does not address what actually started the blackout in the first place, a subject under study at the Department of Energy. Christopher Joyce, NPR News, Washington.
The interim head of the New York Stock Exchange is proposing to restructure the exchange's board and replace current members with former executives who have no connection to the exchange. Richard Reed said he'd ask for the resignations of more than 24 current board members and replace them with an 8-person board. Reed says an independent board would avoid problems such as the enormous pay package given to former CEO Richard Grasso.
The conflicts that existed on the old board that certainly contributed to some of its dysfunction don't exist here.
The plan would have to be approved by the stock exchange's nearly 1,400 members and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 18 points to close at 9,820 in active trading of more than 1.3 billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained a point today to close at 1959. The S&P 500 lost a point to close at 1,051. This is NPR News. The U.S. military says 5 American soldiers were wounded today in a series of grenade and bomb attacks in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. They say at least 3 Iraqi civilians were killed, apparently by fire that was intended to hit American military convoys. Following a high-rise building fire that killed 6 people last month, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley has introduced legislation to toughen the city's fire code. NPR's David Shaper reports from Chicago.
Mayor Daley's proposal would require all commercial high-rises in Chicago that had been exempted from a 1975 sprinkler requirement to be retrofitted with sprinklers within 12 years. The mayor also wants to ban locked stairway doors in high-rises as well. Daley introduced the city fire code changes in the wake of an October 17th fire in a county government administration building in which six people were trapped and killed in a smoky and locked stairwell.
Out of respect for those who lost their lives and to their families, we should do all we can to help assure that a tragedy like this never occurs again in Chicago.
The mayor's proposal exempts residential high-rises and landmark buildings from the sprinkler requirement and instead would require elaborate health safety evaluations of those buildings. But critics want sprinklers required across the board. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
The House has passed a measure that could double the death benefit paid to the families of soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. The measure, which passed unanimously, would pay the survivors of fallen service members $12,000 and make the payment tax-free. The death benefit is intended to help families meet funeral expenses and other immediate costs. The measure is part of a bill that includes other tax breaks for military personnel. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces I Heard It on NPR, Shake These Blues, a compilation of blues tracks by musicians featured on NPR programs at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wanda Jackson has been called the Queen of Rockabilly, but let's face it, there weren't a lot of women rockers who could have been in line for the crown. Jackson toured with Elvis Presley in the mid-50s, and it was the King himself who encouraged her to try to cross over from country to rock and roll. Her biggest rock and roll hit was a song that Elvis recorded first, Let's Have a Party. It was her only record to make it to the top 40. But she also had records on the country music chart, such as In the Middle of a Heartache and Right or Wrong. Now at the age of 65, Jackson has a new CD called Heart Trouble that features her singing with younger performers, including Elvis Costello, Dave Alvin, and Rosie Flores. She does some of the songs she's always performed, as well as more contemporary material. Before we hear music from Heart Trouble, let's go back to her 1958 recording, Let's Have a Party. That's Wanda Jackson's 1958 recording of Let's Have a Party. Wanda Jackson, welcome to Fresh Air. You've been called the Queen of Rockabilly. How did you start performing rockabilly music? I mean, you started off doing country music. How did you make the transition to rockabilly?
Well, you're right. I started in country music. And then in 1955, after I'd graduated from high school, the first touring that I did was with a young fellow early in his career, too, and it was Elvis Presley. And I worked with Elvis off and on for a couple of years, and I could see that this new style of music that he was doing, that, you know, I loved it, and I was with him right as he was really breaking big, you know. And he's the one that encouraged me to try. He said, I think you could sing this kind of music. And being just country, you know, I said, I don't think I could ever get the feel like you do. He said, sure you can. So he encouraged me. He took me to his home and played records, and then he'd sing for me and saying, if you kind of do it this way. And so, you know, I had a good teacher.
So one of the things Elvis was famous for, in addition to his singing style, was how he looked on stage. You know, he was very sexy, and he was very sexually suggestive on stage, particularly for the period. Did you pick up on that aspect as well? Did you change what you wore? Did you change what you did on stage?
Well, I had already changed my stage attire. You know, I didn't want to be in full skirts and cowboy boots and cowboy hat.
Why did you want to change the look?
I don't look good in those things. That was the main thing. I've never been able to wear a full skirt, haven't to this day. And the cowboy hats and those old clubby boots, you know, I just didn't like it. I didn't feel like that was me. because I was a big fan of Marilyn Monroe and Elizabeth Taylor, and I wanted to look like them, you know. I used to go to all the musicals and with paper and pen, and when I'd see a dress I liked, I'd sketch it down real, you know, real fast. And so we've copied one dress off of Betty Grable and one off of Marilyn, and it's kind of funny when I look back at the old pictures and say, oh, I remember where I found that type of dress. What? But my mother was a professional seamstress, and she did all of my costumes for me.
Now, what was it like for you to watch Elvis become this just phenomenon?
Well, it was exciting. I was excited for him. And, of course, like I said, I was 17 and 18 years old, so I was a fan of his as well as a friend, and I was thrilled to death at his success. He was very concerned and disturbed all the time about the things being said to him about his gyrations and things like that, and it really upset him. It hurt him. He was a very sensitive guy, I think. Somewhere along there, about 56, he was getting so popular, they had to stop him from autographing or meeting with his fans, you know. And that really hurt him because he loved his fans and wanted to shake their hands or what have you. But, you know, they were already pulling his coat off and tie and things when I was working with him. And it just got worse. And they said, someone's going to get hurt if we don't stop you from this autographing. So I remember that.
Let's hear a song that you wrote that was a country hit for you. It's called Right or Wrong, and this was recorded in 1960. Did you think of this as more of a country song than a rockabilly?
Yes, I did. I wrote the song, and it was definitely... It really wasn't country, but in the 60s, country music was beginning to use the violin sections and singing groups behind us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really just in the trend of what people like Patsy Cline and were doing, and Brenda Lee and things. So that song was one of the first that lent itself to that type of an arrangement.
Well, let's hear it. This is Wanda Jackson, recorded in 1960, Right or Wrong.
Right or wrong, I'll be with you.
Right or wrong, I'll be with you.
I'll do what you ask me to. For I believe that I belong. By your side, right or wrong. Gotta be.
Wanda Jackson recorded in 1960 her song Right or Wrong. Now, you said before that you weren't really comfortable performing rock and roll to teenagers or rockabilly to teenagers because you were used to performing for adults and you just didn't relate to these teenagers. Did that affect your staying in country music as opposed to trying to cross over more into that teen rock and roll audience?
Yeah, probably so, Terry. If Right or Wrong, you know, right after Let's Have a Party, Right or Wrong became a hit. It was a crossover song, too. meaning it was high on the charts in country, but it was also in the rock and roll, or the, I think then they called it pop and soul music. So it was in the charts, and that's when I tried to do these teenage things and just, you know, didn't really care for it at all. So, yeah, I've considered myself country really all through my career until we get to about 1985, and I was invited to Sweden to record a rockabilly album, and it was from that point on that I realized how popular I was with the new rockabilly fans, not only in Europe, all over Europe and Scandinavia, but also in America eventually.
So you found this more specialized audience who cared a lot about your records.
Mm-hmm. And that's what made it so exciting to see these young adults into this 50s rock music. Mm-hmm. And I've just been having the greatest time working with bands that they sound just like our bands used to, and they're really into the lifestyle, and they drive the classic cars, and they dress in vintage clothes.
Now, I want to play something from your new CD, which is called Wanda Jackson Heart Trouble, and features several guest stars, including Elvis Costello, Dave Alvin, The Cramps. Let's hear a song called Funnel of Love, which also features The Cramps. Do you want to talk about this song and why it's on the CD?
Well, it was on the back of Right or Wrong. And so I didn't think it got much airplay, you know. But a couple of years ago, these new rockabilly fans started requesting Funnel of Love. And I couldn't imagine. So I had to go back and relearn it. And that's why I put it on this album. I thought I'd like for them to have a newer, kind of fresher version. I'm singing it the same, but the music is a little more up-to-date, and well, I wanted to do it.
Well, I'm glad you relearned it. I like the record. This is Funnel of Love from Wanda Jackson's new CD, Heart Trouble. That's Wanda Jackson with The Cramps from her new CD, Heart Trouble. We'll talk more with Jackson after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wanda Jackson, who has been called the Queen of Rockabilly. Now at the age of 65, she has a new CD called Heart Trouble. There are several guest artists on the new CD, Dave Alvin, Elvis Costello, The Cramps. Did you know their work before meeting them for the CD? Mm-hmm. I figure they knew yours, but did you know theirs?
No, not so much, really. I didn't. I'd heard of Elvis Costello, mm-hmm. and I'm sure I'd heard, you know, some of his recordings. But when I met him there in the studio, I brought him my number one box set, the Bear Family Records out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Has put out two box sets on me, and everything that I recorded from 54 to about 73, it's all in there. So I took Elvis the number one box set, and when I said, I'd like for you to have this, he took one look and he said, oh, I already have that one. And I have the number two box set too. So I think when an artist goes out and pays their money to buy, especially the box sets, I figured he must really be a fan. I had been told that he was. And we just had no problem singing together. I'd given him a choice of two or three different duets that I thought might be good, and he chose the one that I really liked the best, Crying Time. And even though our voices blended nicely, I thought, and we sang in the right keys where I could harmonize and then he could harmonize, and it was just a real nice experience.
I want to ask you about something else in your life that I'm sure was a very pivotal experience, a turning point. In 1971, you were born again.
Uh-huh. Right.
If it's not too personal, what happened to you then that was behind such a life-changing experience?
Life-changing, right. Well, I had come to the point in my life where I was realizing that I had everything I'd ever dreamed of wanting. I had a wonderful career, a wonderful husband, two beautiful, healthy children, homes and cars, and, everything that I wanted, and yet I just wasn't happy. And my husband and I, we knew that our marriage was kind of getting in trouble. Our children were being reared by grandmas and governesses, and we knew that some changes needed to be made, but I was fearful of making changes, and I think he probably was too, because our whole lives were wrapped around my career and our traveling. And I was in this frame of mind and all, and my husband too, when we went to church. It was a church that I'd been a member of since I was a little girl, but church had never been important to me personally, at that point. So, the congregation began to sing Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior at the end of the preacher's message. I just realized that God was saying to my heart, Wanda, walk with me. And I could just understand it all of a sudden in my spirit that's what was missing in my life. That's what was wrong. And I turned to my husband and I said, honey, there's something I've got to do. And he knew what I meant, and he said, me too. So in our churches, we go forward publicly and pray and receive Christ. And so that's what we did. We took each other's hands and went down the aisle, and we gave our hearts and lives fully and once and for all to Jesus Christ.
So you've been singing a lot of spirituals since you were born again?
Yes, I've written some and sang a lot of them. Huh?
Mm-hmm. You're speaking to us now from Oklahoma City, which is where you were born, but your parents moved when you were a girl to Bakersfield, California. Do you still have family in Oklahoma City? Is that where you live now?
Yes. I've made it my home, all except for the about 4 years that my folks lived in California. I was a little girl.
I see.
And so I met my husband here, and his folks were here, and with our traveling after we had children, it didn't make sense for us to move to Nashville or Hollywood or something, because with us gone so much, we wanted both sets of parents to be able to drop in and make sure our kids were being taken care of properly. So that was the main reason that we didn't move.
Now, what did your father do for a living when you were growing up?
He was a barber, mm-hmm, for a while, and he drove a cab, and that he was driving a cab when he quit that to travel with me.
Because you were underage when you started performing. You weren't 18 yet, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What was it like being tutored by Elvis and how to play this kind of like sexy, rebellious music when you're traveling with your father?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I thought of it like that. But my dad really liked Elvis. He was a big cut-up, and Elvis was too. And so they kept something going all the time, laughing and various things. And so it worked fine. Now, my dad went along to help me with driving and things like that, but he also, it was very important that my reputation stay intact. And I'm sure that was probably the main reason that he traveled with me. So I wasn't able to ever go from city to city in the car with Elvis, or I had to, you know, Dad had to drive me. I had to be in my car. And, you know, he didn't allow me to sit on someone's lap, and I couldn't lay my head on someone's shoulder if I was sleepy and they were riding with us, you know, and he was pretty strict in those things. But it did keep my reputation intact.
And there you are singing about like broken hearts and let's have a party and riot in cell block number 9.
Yeah.
With a dad making
strange.
Sure that your head isn't on anybody's shoulder. I love that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's quite a contrast, isn't it?
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I've enjoyed all of your questions.
And I, you know, congratulations on your new CD.
Thank you so much.
Wanda Jackson's new CD is called Heart Trouble. Here she is with Elvis Costello. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, it's crying time again. You're gonna leave me. I can see that far away look in your eyes. I can tell by
now they say that absence makes the heart grow fonder, and that tears are only rain to make love grow.
Well, my love for you just couldn't grow no stronger if I live to be 100 years old. Oh, it's crying time again. You're gonna leave me. I can see that far away.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young at bookstores everywhere. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback The Little Friend by Donna Tartt, the author of The Secret History. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet actor Robert Forster. He starred in the 1969 film Medium Cool. His career was revived when he played the bail bondsman in Quentin Tarantino's 1997 film Jackie Brown. In the new ABC crime series Karen Sisko, Foster plays Sisko's father, a detective.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Forster, starred in the now classic 1969 film Medium Cool as a TV news cameraman who remains detached from the cultural upheaval he is reporting. In 1972, Forster starred in the TV series Banyan, but his career never took off. He worked, but many of his roles were in movies like Kinky Coaches and the Pom-Pom Pussycats and Maniac Cop 3, Badge of Honor. But even if casting directors didn't notice his talents, Quentin Tarantino did. He cast Forster in the role of the bail bondsman in the 1997 film Jackie Brown, and that turned things around for Forster. He's since been in Me, Myself, and Irene, Like Mike, Lake Boat, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle, and Mulholland Drive. And now Forster is starring in the ABC series Karen Sisko, adapted from the film Out of Sight, based on characters created by Elmore Leonard. Carla Gugino plays an attractive U.S. Marshal whose dangerous work is always coming into conflict with her personal life. Forster plays her father, a semi-retired private eye. In this scene, they're on the phone together.
Hi, Daddy.
Listen to this. Guy goes in to rob a bank, tells his partner to circle a block. He comes running out, gets hit by a car. Who do you think's driving?
The partner.
Oh, they say irony's dead.
You working today?
Yeah, guy in a wheelchair. Insurance scam.
How'd he get in the chair?
Fell off his desk.
Well, they'll do that on you.
Every damn time. So, this new guy you're seeing, tell him what you do yet?
He still wants to guess.
Sounds like an insurance agent.
Charter fisherman. He owns a boat.
What's his name?
Carl Wilkins.
I always wanted a boat.
Dad, you get seasick.
What's that got to do with the price of eggs? Live by the ocean? Ought to have a boat.
I gotta run.
Why, you got something to do?
Yeah, I'm back at work.
How you feeling?
Not you too.
I'll see you tomorrow night at poker.
Bye, Daddy.
Bye, honey.
Forster has played a lot of cops and private eyes over the years. I asked him if there's anything in those roles that connect with his real personality.
Probably, you know, these guys are straight shooters, no nonsense, if not cynical, at least skeptical, and, you know, you can't put a lot by them. They've seen a lot, and so I take the mantle of that and pretend it's me.
Do you feel like you're that kind of person yourself?
Hardly. you know, I don't know much. My experience is limited by, you know, most human limitations. An actor, you know, actors do things that are, you know, sort of artificial. Notwithstanding, I've read a bunch of stuff of this genre, and so you pick up here and there, and you know, you pretend it's you.
How did you get the part in Karen Sisko?
I was doing pictures. Now, you know, I had a 5-year first act to my career, which ascended, and then a 28-year descending second act to my career. Until Quentin Tarantino handed me Jackie Brown. And that, of course, put me back in business. And from that point, I was doing pictures, which was, you know, which is the big banana of this business, doing movies. While I was doing movies, I had my agent every once in a while would say, you know, there's a television series around the bend somewhere for you. And I'd say, you know, wait till I fail with pictures and let me cool off and eventually we'll do television. But earlier this year, a guy, John McNamara, who was the producer and writer of a show called Fastlane, wrote one for me. I played the father of Peter Facinelli, a guy who I'd worked with on Supernova a few years ago. And what a great part. This was a great character, and I did one episode, and then he wrote a second episode for me, and while we were shooting the second episode, I was on a hillside overlooking Los Angeles. We were standing by a pool waiting for the shot to get set up, and I thought, if I could find a character this good, I would do a television show, because you realize that if you're doing a movie, 10 weeks later, you're done with that character. Television show, if it's a good one, it can last a long time, and you can be doing a great character for a long time. This is it. Now, the minute I said that, apparently he went into motion, and not too long after that, I received this script for Karen Sisko. And I have found the best thing I have... Listen, I've been waiting 40 years for this, and here it is. It's a great character with humor, and I just bring myself to the set. I don't have to do anything more than that. They write great stuff for me.
You had been the star of a TV series before Banyan.
Two series. One was called Banyan, a 30s detective. Old cars, old clothes, old jokes, fast women. They all lied to me. That's what they do in the detective movies. And another television show 2 years later in 1974 called Nakia, a good guy Indian, deputy sheriff, New Mexico, contemporary, cops and robbers in the desert.
Did you like doing either of those?
I did, but I can tell you one thing. It's the hardest job I ever did. I've been an iron worker, and I was worked on the railroad. I was a substitute teacher, but nothing is as hard as carrying a television show. And Carla Gugino, who is the star of Karen Sisko, is the hardest working woman I have ever seen, met. She does short days are 12 hours. Her usual day is probably 13, 15 hours. And I have never heard her complain. She is not delicate. She slugs it out every single day. All I can tell you is that my experience doing my television shows is both of them got canceled half season, and I was relieved. I thought, oh, God, how can I get up another day and face the grind of a television show? So she is champion.
Now, it was Jackie Brown that really revived your career, the Quentin Tarantino movie. It's really a wonderful film, and I should mention it's out on DVD, too. Had you seen Quentin Tarantino's earlier films? I know he'd seen your work, and that's why he wrote the part of the bail bondsman for you, but had you seen his work?
Sure. Strangely, when my career was at its lowest... And I had been doing, you know, dopey exploitation movies for a few different guys who'd hire me. Bill Lustig was one of them, and Fred Williamson was another, and they made, you know, low-budget movies, cop sort of, or horror or whatever. And Lustig called me up one day and said, you know, I just bought a really great script from a guy you never heard of. His name is Quentin Tarantino. And this guy Tarantino claims there's a part in this script that Lustig, he said, was supposed to give to me. And I thought, oh, boy, something to grab onto. My slide is over here. I'm going to get traction with this one. And I read it, and it was great. And before the picture could get made, they grabbed it away from Lustig and gave it to a big director, Tony Scott, and he made True Romance out of it. And then I got a call from my agents.
So you didn't get the part in that after all?
No, I didn't even get close to it. This picture was made with real people, real stars. Then about a year later or so, my agent called me when I had one, who said, "I've got there's a guy you're going to meet for a picture called Reservoir Dogs. You never heard of this guy, Quentin Tarantino," and they sent me the script, and I thought, "Oh boy, my slide is over. This thing is going to be good. This guy likes me. I'm going to get this part." And I went in there at Fox, I remember the reading, and I read this thing good. I knew what I was doing, and after I read it, I walked out of the room. He followed me out of the room, and he said, hey, listen, he said, you know, I've seen everything you ever did, and he started reeling off everything, and he'd seen everything, even the little picture I made, Hollywood Harry. And he said, but look, this thing is not going to work, he said, because I'm going to give this part to the guy that I dedicated the script to, Lawrence Tierney. So... I didn't do that. Following that, he made Pulp Fiction and became a great big director. Years go by. I have breakfast at a place in Hollywood, West Hollywood, and I went into breakfast one morning. I'm sitting there, and in walks Quentin, and I call him over, and he comes over, and we blah, blah for a few minutes, and I ask him what he's doing, and he said he's adapting Rum Punch, an Elmore Leonard novel, to a movie. He said, why don't you read it? That was that. About 6 months later, I walk into the same restaurant. I turn the corner into the patio to go toward my own spot. Quentin's sitting in my seat. As I approach, he picks up a script. He hands it to me. He says, read this, see if you like it. Now, there has never been such a gift. He gave me a gift the size of which cannot be exaggerated.
Did you feel like you should be talking him out of it because you felt washed up? Do you know what
I
mean?
I didn't feel washed. No, listen, I knew that if I hung in there long enough, I had a long shot strategy, and that was that someday some kid who liked me growing up would turn into a movie maker and give me a good part.
Oh.
How do you like that?
It worked.
It worked.
My guest is Robert Forster. He's co-starring in the ABC series Karen Sisko. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Forster. He starred in the now classic 1969 film Medium Cool as a TV news cameraman who was detached from the cultural upheaval he's reporting on. The movie incorporated real footage from the protests surrounding the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Forster's career was revived when Quentin Tarantino cast him in a leading role in the 1997 film Jackie Brown. Well, let me play a scene from Jackie Brown. This is a scene from early on. You're a bail bondsman, and Samuel Jackson, who has lived a life of crime, is coming to you to get a bail bond for Jackie Brown.
All right. You want another bond? You want to move the $10,000 you got on Beaumont over to the stewardess? That means paperwork. I got to get a death certificate, present it to the court, make out a receipt for return of bond collateral, type up another application.
Hey, man, Jackie ain't got time for all that.
I'm telling you what I have to do. What you have to do, in case you forgot, is come up with a premium of $1,000.
I can do that. You know I got the money. I just ain't got it with me.
Come back when you do. I'll bond out the stewardess.
Look, you got to look at this with a little compassion, all right? Jackie ain't no criminal. She ain't used to this kind of treatment. Now, gangsters, they don't give a but you're on your average citizen. A couple of nights in county get the with their mind.
Ordell, this isn't a bar. You don't have a tab.
Listen to me, all right? You got a 44-year-old, gainfully employed black woman, falsely accused.
Falsely accused? She didn't come back from Mexico with cocaine on her?
Falsely accused of intent? Now, if she had that shit, and mind you, I'm saying if, that was her own personal shit to get high with.
Is white guilt supposed to make me forget I'm running a business?
Oh, it's like that, huh?
That's Samuel Jackson. And my guest, Robert Forster, in a scene from Jackie Brown, a film by Quentin Tarantino. Now, one of the things I love about this film is this part of the story between you and Pam Grier, who's your female co-star in the movie. And it's a great love story because you never know if she's really on the level. And also, it's a real like middle-aged love story. You know, she's middle-aged, you're middle-aged. And it's also an interracial love story. And it really works. What did you think the odds were that when you were coming out of this long phase where you weren't getting work, you'd get this kind of leading man role? And it's not leading man role in the sense that, you know, it's like James Bond or the hunk.
No, it was better than that. It was real.
It's
it was
real,
human.
Exactly.
It was
yeah.
human and
it has
it was
so much
believable
feeling in
stuff.
It. Yeah.
And,
uh-huh.
You know, and that is sort of what Elmore Leonard is about, real characters. He has affection for his characters. They're human, and even if they're bad guys, he has affection for them and knows that they, knows they have a real life and laugh once in a while and are not just bad guys. Elmore Leonard and Quentin Tarantino, and Tarantino, of course, I know quite well at this point, and I know what his dialogue is like. He took it from Elmore Leonard, but it's really his own. And this guy has a real ear for knowing what people speak like, especially characters neighborhood characters and people from different places. He's got a real ear for it.
There's a kind of air of depression and loneliness that hangs over your character in Jackie Brown. I'd just be interested in hearing what you did to get in the right frame of mind for the role.
I had a 28-year slide to my career. Boy, listen, you know, I must have asked myself 400 times, are you going to survive this, Bob? Are you going to be able to save the house? Are you going to get the kids through college? Are you going to, you know, survive a relationship? Will anybody love you at the end? Is it going to be all lonely, or is it going to be, you know, who knows what? And, you know, you survive it, and you keep on slugging, and you refuse to quit.
During that period when you weren't working much, you were still making some movies, and some of them sound like they were, you know, real cheap films like Satan's Princess. And
oh, what a cutie that was.
Was it? What are some of the other titles from that period?
Oh, boy. There were some, you know, there's a series, if you look on the internet, it used to be on, I think they've taken them off now, but for a couple of years after Jackie Brown, there were still a couple of Spanish titles on my website, not my website, but the database. And those pictures were made by an actor who, in Spain, about, I don't know, 20 years ago, used my name. Somebody told him that he looked like me, and so he used my name in Spanish pictures, one of which is called, and you could find it, and it's a better title than I'm going to tell you, but the witch nymphomaniac from the Rio Grande, and at least two or three of those kind of titles, and a few other titles of my own that, you know, equally terrible and forgettable, but there are some little pictures made during those years that I loved.
Well, you actually started your career with a splash. In 1969, you were the star of Medium Cool, and you played a TV cameraman.
Yep.
It was set in the present. In fact, there were, or more or less the present, there were scenes that were actually shot at the demonstrations at the Chicago Convention and inside the Chicago Convention. Were there things about the movie that surprised you, such as having to film in the context of the real Democratic Convention?
This movie was one of my great learning experiences. Up until then, I didn't realize that an actor might be called upon to improvise. There was an awful lot of this movie that was improvised, and I hadn't a clue. I thought they wrote the words for you. So now I'm with Haskell, and he hands me a camera and says, okay, do an interview with that person over there. And with nothing more than let's see how we do this, I started talking, and the next thing you know, you're improvising and bringing the character that you imagine you are supposed to be. I had gotten a great lesson from John Huston.
He directed you in Reflections in a Golden Eye.
Yes, my first picture. I met him in a hotel room. I arrived from L.A. I had read the book, Reflections in a Golden Eye. I showed up. I walked into the lobby of this hotel, and I looked around, and everywhere, there were guys. They all looked like me. I thought he wanted to meet me for Reflections in a Golden Eye. This was a cattle call. They called my name. I was escorted up the elevator. We waited outside of a room. Somebody left. I walked in. I'm introduced to this tall old guy. He says, "What have you done? What have you done?" I said, "Listen, I haven't done much. I did one Broadway play. It wasn't bad, but I don't make myself an actor. I never did a movie. I don't know how they're made. I don't know what the tricks are, but if you hire me, I'll give you your money's worth." He gave me the job. On the first day of production, I get out of the car. I'm walking over to where he's standing. He says, "Now's the time, Bobby." I say, "Shoot, I'm all ears." He says, "Go take a look through the lens." I walked over to the camera. The cameraman stepped aside. I looked through the lens. I turned back to Huston. He's got his hands shaped in the form of a rectangle. He said, "You see those? Those are the frame lines." I looked again through the lens. I said, "Yeah, you mean that line that shows the cameraman what the audience sees?" He says, "Those are the frame lines. Now ask yourself this. What needs to be there?" Wow. In 14 words, this guy gives me the secret. The actor is supposed to understand and imagine what is supposed to be inside that frame and deliver it. And deliver what the writer needs and what the director may need. And it's got to be there because the guy who set the lights wants you to be in him. And you got to hear the ones who are listening for the words, got to hear them correctly. Otherwise, somebody at the end of the shot says, "No good for sound, start again." And if you do something too big for the frame you're in, somebody says, "No good for composition, start again." And if you put the cup in the wrong spot, somebody says, "No good for continuity." You've got to deliver a stroke which advantages everybody's needs at once. And when you do that, you get to hear cut, print, move on to the next shot. John Huston gave me a great piece of advice, and I took that to Haskell Wexler's picture, and I said to myself, okay, what's supposed to be here? And then he would say action, and I'd throw something out there.
One of the things you had to do in Medium Cool was be naked.
Oh!
And how'd you feel about that?
You know, okay, here comes the first thing. Oh, what a fun thing this was. I got the script to Reflections in a Golden Eye. That's where it started. And I read this thing, and here it says, yeah, the guy rides around naked on a horse. And I'm thinking to myself, and I'd never made a movie, I hadn't a clue. And I said, gee, I wonder how they do that. Probably trick photography or something. Yeah. So I remember the day I was in Rome, and when I came out to the set, and here was an Italian extra riding around the horse naked. And I thought to myself, gee, that's supposed to be me. And I was so taken in the moment. I said to John Huston, I said, I could do that. I could do that. He said, could you, Bobby? Could you really? I said, yeah, I could do that. I didn't want the other guy to be in the picture. I wanted to do that thing. It was my own. So the next thing I know, the wardrobe department hands me a little tiny triangle cut from a jock strap, all right, and a roll of tape. And they handed this to me, and that was supposed to give me some my modesty, yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, it unpeeled immediately. So, you know what? I said, Bob, if you don't give yourself permission to do this, then why do it? You know, you either got to give yourself full permission to be absolutely unafraid, and if you don't, you're dead. You can't proceed in this thing. It's like being afraid. You got to overcome fear, the fear of being on stage, for one thing. I mean, that fear of stage fright. I remember the first time I had stage fright. I was in the University of Rochester, and I had done a play sort of accidentally. I chased a girl into the auditorium. I wanted to say something to her. She was in a play. I got in the play. That's how I met the girl. Later, I married her. You have to overcome stage fright, and I had to overcome the fear of doing that. After that, in Medium Cool, it wasn't that hard. Haskell said, you think you can get Mariana Hill to be naked? I said, why ask me? You're the director. You're supposed to ask her, not me. He said, yeah, but, you know, I'm a little embarrassed. I said, so don't ask me. Next thing I know, she said, sure. And the next thing he says, well, if she's naked, you know, you got to be naked too. I said, like hell. He says, yeah, because otherwise it looks stupid. Anyway, round two, I say, okay, Bob, let's go. You're not that afraid of it. Let's try. And bingo, bango.
And you're chasing each other around the room, having fun.
Yeah.
Were you embarrassed at all? Or were you not
well,
really
sure,
painfully
I was a little,
modest?
Oh, painfully modest. And don't forget, I lived in Rochester. I had neighbors. I had a mother-in-law. I had cousins and everybody. And you know, I... But, you know, that's what you do. You say either be unafraid or don't do it.
My guest is Robert Forster. He's co-starring in the new ABC series, Karen Sisko. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Forster in the ABC series, Karen Sisko. He plays Sisko's father, a semi-retired private eye. His career was revived when he starred in Quentin Tarantino's film, Jackie Brown. Now, I read that your father, before World War II, was worked with Ringling Brothers Circus as an elephant trainer.
He was on the Ringling, yeah. Oh, what a good guy this guy is. I remember when I went to him. At the end of my senior year at the University of Rochester, I went to him and I said, Dad, I said, you know what? I don't think I want to be a lawyer. I want to be an actor. And he, who had, as you know, been an elephant trainer on the Ringling before World War II, did not miss a beat. He said, I think you could do that, Bob. And this guy pulled for me for over 30 years. And He died just before Jackie Brown was released, but he saw some of the shooting. He came out for a circus event in the last 10 years or so of his life. We did a lot of circus events together. They've got circus groups and old fan organizations and some old circus performers. And he had come out to San Francisco, and we did a four-day event. And he came here to Los Angeles, and on the night before, he went back to Rochester. And he was ill at the time. He was really on his last legs, and I was worried that he wasn't going to manage. I was worried that I wasn't going to see him again when I put him on that plane. But the last night before he went back to Rochester, he was on the set. We had a night shoot. And at the end of that, when I was taking him to the airport, he said, you know, this picture's going to do you a lot of good, Bob. This guy's very, very good. Quentin, you want to know what a good guy he is, cut some scenes together when the picture was over in days. He cut some scenes together and sent them to me on videotape to show to my father, which was only days before he passed.
That's really
this
nice.
This is a good, good guy.
Just a question about your accent. I always assumed you were from Chicago. Maybe that's because I saw you in the movie adaptation of David Mamet's Lake Boat.
I'm from Rochester, which is a Great Lakes accent. I imagine that the Great Lakes were far more influenced one another than, for instance, from Rochester down to New York City, which are very different accents. So Rochester, Buffalo, Erie, not Detroit so much, but Chicago, and almost all those cities have a similar accent, a long A. I know I sound that way. Not much to do about it. Just got to live with what you got.
Are there times when you feel that really works for you and other times when you feel you should play it down?
You know, I never try to play it down. I figure that's what they hired and that's what they're going to get. It's easier to deliver yourself than it is to make up somebody. If you try to make somebody up, you know, it's pretty thin. It's kind of a veneer. You got your real self to deliver. And what could be better than that?
Robert Forster, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Robert Forster co-stars in the series Karen Sisko. The next episode will be broadcast tonight on ABC. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Cross 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Given Up for Dead, America's Heroic Stand at Wake Island by Bill Sloan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Philadelphia Police Sergeant Noman Shubar. 22 years ago, he left his home in Iraq to move to the U.S. He returned for the first time in May and spent 4 months patrolling post-war Baghdad and helping train the new Iraqi police force. Among his arrests, two faces from the deck of cards. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.